Welcome back, everyone. In case you hadn't heard, I'm Nate Bennett. This is the second episode of Chefaleptic, my autobiographical podcast series. Some subjects discussed in this episode are looking back at deja vu, the spells of aura, and the good old days. If you enjoy this episode, and or it makes you think of someone who might, share it. Why not? All it will cost anybody is a little time. Chapter 5.
Looking back.
It took me a while to really put together that every time I had experienced that one odd deja vu feeling, ever since I was a little kid, I was having a seizure. That was part of the whole realization that was really the most bizarre for me. The fact that something that I would later think of as a serious medical situation where the brain flips out and tells its own body to quit breathing and beat the shit out of itself for however long wasn't just some strange, innocent feeling I had sometimes when I was a kid. Now, if I ever feel that feeling starting up, it's time to immediately fasten my seatbelts and warn everyone around me. It also means that any plans or progress I've made in my world since last time it happened might just get kicked all around yet again. Looking back, I've also realized that before that first time I ended up in the emergency room, there were at least two other events that I'm now totally sure were full-blown seizures, just missed and misdiagnosed. Nobody's fault, really. One of those times, it was years ago in February of 1995. I was back in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, where I lived in Houghton Hancock, where the college I dropped out of, Michigan Tech University, is located. I was a cook at what was arguably the best restaurant in town, the Library. I was situated pretty good then, because besides it being kind of freaking freezing cold and buried with snow a lot of the time, it was relatively easy living there from an economic perspective. I'd been playing in a band and partying by night while cooking, and of course eating, by day, so I was relatively well-fed, and I even got some regular gigs out of the same establishment I cooked at on the weekends. Heck, why would I ever need a degree? As I'm sure is still the case, the folks that lived up around those parts made a regular point to party real good and not let the whole big, long, heavy northern winter thing get them down. Every year, an event called Winter Carnival takes over the town, and some super creatively designed and amazingly executed ice sculptures get put together for a big contest. I recommend that if, when you find yourself with a little time, you might maybe treat yourself to searching Michigan Tech Winter Carnival online, because I guarantee you will see some amazing pictures. A contest is held, and many of the sculptures end up being like stories high and sometimes take weeks of construction to complete, and students stay up all night before the judging, applying all the details and drinking and partying their asses off. I don't know exactly what I was doing during this particular winter carnival, but I'm willing to bet the evenings for me had featured some big partying and jamming going on pretty late, and I know that the Library restaurant I cooked at was pumping out high volume as I was working my usual day shifts. For the businesses in that town, this event is the biggest shindig of the year in terms of making the tourist dollars, and I definitely did some ass-busting at the restaurant to help feed the big swell. The three-story restaurant had an interesting setup. The kitchen was in the basement with seating on the two floors above. Waitstaff would write down orders on paper slips that they would clip to old-fashioned wooden clothespins and then drop down a tube. We cooks would hear the orders come down the chute and then clunk a plate, and when the food was done, it was sent up the dumbwaiters, a counterweighted pulley system with cabinets we'd used to send the food up to the first and second floor service areas. It was pretty cool, unless the pulley pin stopper thing ever failed. I saw that thing come down full force all the way from the top story with a whole hot pot full of the famous creamy Swiss onion au gratin house soup one time. Luckily, nobody in the kitchen got hit by it, but damn, it made a hell of a splatter on impact. Talk about a true chaos moment in the kitchen, but I digress. Anyways, I had been making a batch of that soup on the stove. I recall it took over a gallon of chopped onions to start with, and the recipe began by sautéing them in the bottom of a big old 5-gallon soup pot until they were transparent. A great soup, really. Taught me how to be a badass onion chopper for sure, and to breathe through my mouth when chopping all those onions. I had made this soup like millions of times. I knew I had a sec to run upstairs and use the bathroom before the onions would need stirring attention, so I had put the big pot on a low burner and headed on up to do my business. It was a sit-down situation, and as I stood up from the toilet to button my britches, I passed out. I still remember waking up on the bathroom floor. First thought, my onions. The boss would be pissed if those things got burnt. How did I get on this floor? How long had I been there? What was I thinking? It was carnival time, and I knew right away I needed to get my ass back to that kitchen. I managed to get my pants up and staggered back through the damn crammed, busy dining area. How could I have known I was all bloody? Not like I had time to look in the bathroom mirror or anything. I ran down the stairs through the little office area into the kitchen where the stockpot still sat on full flame, to my horror. Immediately, my cooking skill set kicked in as I assessed whether or not any of the onions could be saved. They were starting to get roached all right, but maybe 2/3 or so could still be used. Of course, I don't recall whether I had washed my hands before touching the equipment or doing anything else logical or sanitary like that. I just remember being told I had to go to the hospital. At some point, I finally saw my reflection. I had blood drying all over my face. I guess I had been missing from the kitchen for quite a while, long enough to roach my onions. I heard later that beneath the restroom area down in the kitchen, a shuffling sound on the floor above had been heard, and someone said that they thought I might have been recruited to help move something around upstairs. I apparently was moving something around on the men's room floor, myself. I don't recall how I got there, but I ended up at the local emergency room. I remember talking with a younger female doctor about the event. She thought I was probably just hypoglycemic, meaning my blood sugar was too low, and that had likely caused me to faint. I'll never forget what happened next. She asked me some basic question about my medical history, and I answered her with something other than what I meant to say. In a big way, I heard my mouth detour away from the orders my brain was sending it, somehow spouting out whatever it wanted to say instead. It was my first taste of a bizarre malfunction I now understand doctors refer to as aphasia. Basically, the signal between the conscious controlling part of the brain and the mouth gets interfered with, and just about any salad of jumbled-ass BS words can come rolling out. And being able to hear your mouth do this while not being able to shut it the fuck up at your own will is a downright weird place to be, I just gotta say. So anyways, my mouth decided to say, well, my doctor downstate says I should have a pizza. I froze, and I'm sure the conflicted look on my face was a flag for her. I know the whole look on her face spoke to me, because she gave me the total, seriously, look for a sec, and then she smiled, pointed at me, and said, you're getting a CAT scan. That was a computer axial tomography scan, which didn't end up showing any problems, but did cost me like $400 or $500. Of course, that was way before I ever had any medical insurance. So, I chalked the whole event up to partying too hard, followed by working too hard without eating enough. I was relatively skinny but in decent shape, so I didn't really think that having a blood sugar issue was a constant problem. I just figured I overdid it and passed out and maybe hit my head a little bit. As I would do later in life, I arranged some payments for the emergency room visit and the CAT scan, but that's where concerns stopped for a while. Then, in March of 1999, I had the next neuro event that I also later realized was a grand mal seizure that had gone unrecognized. At that time, I was living in a beater house that I was sharing with my bandmates out in California in the little mountain town of Boulder Creek near Santa Cruz, about 70 miles south of San Francisco. The thing with that one was that it was over before anybody knew what was up. It had apparently started in my sleep. It was a two-story house, and my mattress was on the floor of a large walk-in closet upstairs. I woke up with dark circles under my eyes, darker than any lack of sleep causes. I had black eyes, and I mean both of them. I had probably bonked my nose at some point. This time, I had bitten my tongue. Not nearly as bad as I later got to find out I could bite it, but bad enough to make me wonder how in the hell I could do that and not wake up. I sure know now how it happens. My housemates had asked me what the hell I was doing in there that morning. Apparently for quite a while they could hear me thrashing around and or maybe going through the confused wandering and falling and partial consciousness stuff that happens after I have convulsions, which I now know is called the post-ictal phase. But at that point, none of us knew I had epilepsy. Admittedly, I probably wouldn't have come up with that guess either about whatever commotion I had made. Maybe my housemates were even being optimistic for me, like thinking I might have had some company over or whatever. Either way, that one didn't end up costing me any money or forcing me to make any big life changes, so I wasn't really super alarmed. I just healed up and time rock and rolled on. When I was discussing my medical history with my dad years later, he told me that he also felt pretty sure that he saw me have an episode around age 13 or so out in the backyard, but he didn't know it was a seizure then either. I don't remember that one, but as I've learned, I often forget what happens when I have these events. Knowing that means, of course, that I may have had any number more unidentified episodes before I was finally officially diagnosed. Despite all the episodes and events I had been through growing up, I hadn't yet put together that I had ever suffered any kind of seizures until it all changed and the whole next chapter started when I got to take that first ambulance ride at age 26. I was lucky enough to have lived in my state of blissful ignorance for my younger years, and I know now that I need to always keep in mind that this, in itself, is something that I can be very grateful for. Chapter 6.
The Spells.
Something else I've come to realize I can be grateful for are those spells of deja vu I talked a bit about before. After learning that I have seizures, I naturally began reading more and more about epilepsy and neurological disorders of all kinds. I kind of couldn't help myself. For one thing, the old gray matter is a pretty fascinating thing. The way the brain works, and doesn't work, is just so incredible, yet it's so incredibly hard to understand. Some super dedicated people spend their entire careers studying it, trying to figure it out. Yet somehow, when more is learned about how it actually works, there is very often some exception to the rule. And from what I have come to understand, I represent at least one, if not more, of those exceptions. So, of course, I've come to respect that I am far from being the deepest understander, despite all the reading I've done and experiences I've had. I've also come to realize that I have had the rare privilege to meet and be treated by some of the most knowledgeable and capable doctors that I could have ever hoped would be available during my time. And I've learned about many kinds of seizures that caused many different symptoms and behaviors. More classifications have been made and more symptoms have been labeled as this area of medicine has evolved. Some seizures happen more often, even constantly, whereas other varieties, like mine, can be very irregular and unpredictable. They also can cause a wide variety of physical behaviors based on what part of the brain flips out and what part it controls. What I mean by flips out is going through a period of electrical malfunction, when the electrical signals that routinely travel through our brains for some reason derail from their usual paths and routines that basically cause some amount of trouble in our heads. And when this happens, because different areas of the brain do different things, different parts of our body do any number of abnormal things because their corresponding controller is not functioning as usual. Not all seizures may cause the person having them to lose consciousness. Some aren't even outwardly obvious. They could just cause any amount of memory to get lost, or the person may behave differently in any number of crazy ways without doing the obvious flopping around fit stuff. And it has taken medicine a long time to break down and begin to better understand and diagnose these different varieties of seizures and their causes. From what I've learned, something like 10% of us probably have some kind of seizure at some point during our lives. Now, arguably, that number may be larger if you consider that a person may or may not be alone when this happens, and therefore may not have another person present to witness it and be able to describe what happened after it's over. Also, some episodes are likely simply misdiagnosed as having been triggered by some other cause, as first happened in my case. Something more like 1% of us end up having diagnosed repeated seizures of some kind or another. Out of that 1%, about half of those have some obvious cause that the doctors can point to, such as a tumor, stroke, injury, you get the idea. The other half of that percentage are in the category I fall into, when whatever pictures and scans don't tell the doctors easily and obviously where and why and what the cause is. Also, for those of us that do go full bore and do the whole gnarly convulsing thing, about half know when it's starting up. I am very grateful to be in that half. For the most part, I've learned to associate that deja vu moment I get with meaning that I have to get ready when my episodes are starting to happen. It saved my ass a number of times to have even a short moment to prepare, and I really feel for the folks out there that don't get warned as I do. They just go off and probably go down too. God help you people. Hang in there. Medicine is really trying. I know it is. What basically happens is that a storm starts brewing in the brain, and depending on what section of the big library has the issue, the information and functions stored in that area get scrambled, and for some, a warning is triggered. Depending on what neighboring sections of the library are nearby, seizures can involve varying areas that also cause different parts of the body to jiggle or droop or go rigid without conscious control as they happen. Those of us who do get some kind of warning that our seizures are starting don't all experience the same thing, described by their subtypes. Not everyone that has a warning experiences déjà vu. Some people experience certain flavors or odors that suddenly show up out of nowhere as they begin to seize. I remember reading about a person who would always start to smell cinnamon, and another that would suddenly taste chocolate as their episodes would begin. Medicine has now labeled this intro phase of seizure episodes the aura. It means that part of the brain has slipped into seizure activity, but the whole brain probably isn't totally going off yet. This can give the person some amount of warning before they fully go into the phase known in medicine as the grand mal, which is Latin for big problem. For many people who have seizures, the aura does not always lead to a full-blown grand mal seizure. In my case, when I was younger, I was less likely to go off all the way after an aura, but as I got older and started having more seizures, it became almost inevitable that I would. When a seizure does stop after the aura phase, it is usually classified as a petit mal seizure, meaning small problem. This means that only part of the brain went into seizure mode, but it chillaxed back down before the whole dang neighborhood joined into a full-blown riot. I've learned that I'm not the only person that experiences déjà vu during the aura phase of my seizures. For those who don't know, déjà vu is a French term that we English speakers borrow, which directly translates to already seen. It's a phrase someone uses to describe the feeling that they've already been here and done this before. It totally made sense to me that other people that have seizures might have made the exact connection with these words that I did. I mean, if you had experienced something like a strong, strange feeling when you were very young, you would likely reflect back to that time if you had that same feeling again later in life, wouldn't you? I have, many times. So many times that not only me, but also the people around me in my world that have seen this happen to me have come to refer to these moments as my spells. Apparently, about 10 times less common than those of us who experience déjà vu before seizures are those who have an experience called jamais vu, meaning never seen, during the aura phase of their seizures. This sounds to me like it must really suck. And I say that not to sound like I'm some kind of seizure elitist, but rather because of the descriptions that I have read, which almost never have any positive sounding spin on them. For these seizure sufferers, all of the sudden, they don't know who they are, where they are, how they got where they are, who they're with, etc., etc., and it's usually described as a truly terrifying experience. It really does sound like it can be horrible for them, and I've developed much sympathy and respect for these people. So, as I see it now, even though I've had many heavy seizures and a few brain surgeries, it all could have still gone a lot worse for me if not for the deja vu auras I've oddly been blessed with that have given me that here it comes so many times. I'm always recalling different events where I had that warning moment, and it has made all the difference. Like the time when I was riding my bicycle at night and it warned me in time for me to get away from the road and slip into a closed U-Haul truck rental place. I woke up next to my bike, took my wallet out from between my teeth and headed on. And there was that time when I was right by Santa Cruz City Hall and had a similar experience right on the lawn. I don't know how long I was out, but none of the people who were crowded there occupying the area at that time took my wallet or my bike. And then there was that time I was with my dad and my buddy Mark in my car as I drove up Highway 1 along the coast north of Santa Cruz, and I managed to pull my car over to the side before I got out in a daze and wandered through the two-way traffic until the two of them managed to tackle me. And of course, there were all those times I managed to slip away while I was working, to restrooms or offices or out to loading docks or down to storage rooms or under the stairs. So, when I'm reminding myself of all the reasons to not let myself wander into that downward cycle of self-pity, I include the fact that I have had the protection of all those warnings to help me manage my condition, and that for such a long time as I was younger, all they did to me was make me have a little gazing off, remembering when I was a kid time. Naivete truly was bliss. Those deja vu spells of mine have been my allies, even though they eventually also became my forewarning alert system. Chapter 7.
The Days of Old.
On August 9th, 1995, I arrived in California with my three bandmates, Timothy, Zoltan, and John. We had traveled about 2,300 miles all the way from Houghton Hancock in northern Michigan's Upper Peninsula. It took us a few days on the road. We had two vehicles, John's beat-up 80s-era white Astro-type van and my 78 Chevy Impala. My car was pulling my trailer, which was the shell of the bottom of an old pop-up camper that we'd mounted a pickup truck bed topper onto, a real classy rig. We'd brought every damn large and small piece of music gear we owned, along with a relatively minimal amount of personal stuff. John's little dog, Delta, was also in his van. He wouldn't have considered leaving her behind. This was back in the Stone Age, before cell phones were considered a common necessity, but we had some old-school radio tech going on. Both vehicles had CB radios. Thing was, the one in my car was lousy and the one in the van was better, which meant it could hear and talk back at ya over much larger distances. This meant that if we in my car wanted to find out what was going on out there, we had to call the van and have them find out who's got their ears on out there and report the skinny they could find back to us. Hopefully, I'll never forget that trip, especially when we were in the final stretch on the road that last evening. I forget what highway we were on, but I do remember as evening came that we were in a desert scene and the sun was setting on the right side as the moon was rising on the left. I guess that means at that point we were heading mostly south. It was awesome weather and all windows were rolled down. I turned on my radio and the first station we found some music on was playing some obscure old Grateful Dead from a bootleg. It was classic. I mean, here we were in California, IA. I called up John's van with the CB, and they tuned into the same radio station. Soon we were passing each other on the highway, singing along at each other with some old song, with all of us just so glad we had finally made it. Then a DJ cut in and said something like, "Sorry if you haven't heard it yet, but Captain Trips has left the planet." "That's right. Jerry Garcia, age 57, died today." And on with the news flash. Both of our vehicles kind of slid around on the road with shocked surprise, and I remember looking over at John in the van window as he made exclaiming, disbelieving movements with his arms. What a day to just happen to arrive in the infamous Bay Area of jams. Our band had been playing music together for a few years in our home college town where we all met. We'd been gradually writing and playing more and more of our own original material, and over time, we had formed a pretty strong commitment to our project. We had already been through quite a bit together and all wanted to see it somehow mean something bigger. It was still a few years before any of us found out anybody had any strange diseases, or kids. Not to compare those two kinds of major life-changing situations, but sometimes I do wonder how people manage to raise them things, or live through whatever number of diseases, but again, no comparing going on there. John was my dorm mate at 350 West in Wadsworth Hall at Michigan Tech University, where we spent our freshman year of college. MTU's in Houghton, a 500-mile drive from my hometown of East Lansing in Lower Michigan, and about 400-some-odd miles away from John's homeland near Chicago. We had met Zoltan immediately. He was just down the hall, and he and I had helped each other get our lofts into our rooms. He was also from the Chicago area. The dorm is a big, huge, long, monster, rectangular brick building, the biggest on the whole Michigan Tech campus, and supposedly was once the largest dorm hall in America. I remember when my dad was first dropping me off at the dorm. We had moved some of my stuff into the empty room and then had gone out to get something to eat. When we came back to the room, my roommate John had been there and had moved a couple of his things in, but he wasn't there. He had thumbtacked a photograph to the wall, which I was just checking out when John walked in and we met the first time. The photo was a mediocre quality color snapshot of Jerry Garcia, autographed to John with a Sharpie. Me and John and Zoltan started playing music together pretty quickly, and eventually we played with a number of other guys over the next couple of years. We had started playing covers of what we considered classic rock and roll, in other words, hippie-era stuff. As we progressed, the three of us got more serious about writing, performing, and conquering the universe. At some point, the drummer we had been playing with left us hanging, quitting on us right before a big gig we had set up with another band of our friends called Patchwork Apple. The show was at the locally famous Calumet Theater, an 18th century opera hall, and proceeds were to benefit the hall. It was a pretty terrible show for me and John and Zoltan. We had to play sitting down, acoustic style, even though we had been advertising and planning it like a full-bore, plugged-in project, so it was anticlimactic for us, to say the least. Something good did come out of that event, though. When we finished playing, we met our new friend Timothy. He had come to see the show, and as we were packing up, he walked up on the stage and introduced himself to us and told us he wanted to be our new drummer. Timothy had grown up in the area. He was like 3 years younger than us, still in high school and not even old enough to legally play bars with us at first, but as soon as we jammed with him, we knew we had our man. From then on out, it would be the four of us. Before the Opera Theater show, John and Zoltan and me had decided to rename the band How's Your Day, because John had exclaimed sarcastically, "How's your day?" and threw his hands in the air as we had gotten the great news that our drummer was flaking on us. Once Timothy joined us, we had a local guy in the band. We adjusted the band name spelling a touch, intending to emulate the local accent by working in a schwa, you know, the upside-down lowercase e used in old-school dictionaries to spell out pronunciations. Actually, maybe we just liked to say schwa and thought it would be cool to have one in the name, and we used the local accent concept as an excuse to put it there. It was our damn word, and we knew what it meant. Well, I could probably write a whole nother book's worth about all the crazy times we shared together over the next few years, but the big thing was we all had some great times and made true friends of each other and had some great times with lots of other great folks around us, too. I quit school after my first year, and John about a year after that. Zoltan was the only one of us who stuck it through and got his 4-year degree in 4 years. He's like that. Smart, stubborn, wise, eventually becoming a metallurgical engineer. After the three of us Michigan Tech guys were out of the dorm, John and I became roomies, sharing a couple different spots with more and more geeked out rehearsal spaces in pads we'd refer to as the band house. It was a pretty cheap area to live in rent-wise. It had once been an active mining region, but that had all died off quite a while back, leaving lots of huge, half-sunken, rusting debris leaning around, with much of the remaining inhabitable housing and buildings usually being rented cheap to the students and staff of the university. Overall, the Upper Peninsula of Michigan hasn't kicked much economic ass in quite a while. It's more sparsely populated than the Lower Peninsula, and it's a more rugged environment that has considerably more fierce weather. Up there in the upper northwestern corner of the state where we were, there's lots of lake effect from Lake Superior, causing long, heavy winters with piles of snow, snow, snow. It was a great environment for house parties. Back then, word would get out that a party was going on somewhere, and the hosting houses, which were usually frats and sororities, would be charging at the door and tapping kegs one after the other, all you care to chug. Word would go around after parties about how many barrels were consumed, which naturally was a direct function of how much fun was had by how many people. Of course, many of us who consumed were underage, and of course, whoever the host was would be very unlikely to be a licensed distributor of alcohol. Back then, people were just starting to take drunk driving more seriously, so there would be whatever designated driving arrangements or just stumbling home through the snow after the fun. But man, them parties did go on. Sometimes there would be bands at the parties, and sometimes we'd be one of them. We made friends and shared shows with lots of other bands of different styles, like punk or alternative or folky or whatever. The town was only so big, and we were like one of the representative, freaky, classic, psychedelic rock-influenced jam bands on the scene. We stacked up and refined more and more original material and gradually got more motivated to record it. As we did, more and more, we learned more and more about recording. We finally got serious enough to record a demo, and we were trying to figure out how and to who we would submit it to, and what we might do with our game, while we all sat up there feeling like we were stuck in a snowdrift in a small town in the middle of northern nowhere. That situation just couldn't last forever, as much as I know we all loved living there. Eventually, we just had to at least try to make our combined efforts mean something more somehow. I'd come to school at Tech for an associate's degree in forest technology. Apparently, at some point, I was not only considering becoming a lumberjack, but even paying to learn how, until I made some realizations during my first year. Although I liked the idea of working in the forest every day, I learned right away that it's basically one of the most dangerous jobs in America, and the pay's not usually exactly all that great, especially when you consider the risk. Then, I freaked out about how much money I had already borrowed to pay for the first year of school, and I just said no thanks to finishing the degree. I got a job at the library bar and restaurant and ended up working there for the next few years. I had worked in kitchens since I was 15, but a year of that was fast food and the rest was scrubbing dishes. The library was where I'd learned my core cooking skills. John had managed to hang in there a little longer with the school thing, but eventually he followed my bad example and quit school. Soon, we were both working in the library's kitchen and were roommates in a nearby three-story duplex. The band's gear was all crammed into the attic, which we had soundproofed with old mattresses nailed to the rafters and covered over with thick black trash bag-looking plastic. Our band stayed pals with Patchwork Apple. Their band was a seven-piece, and like us, they were gradually making more and more of their own songs. One of their members was this asshole Mike Fermeni. No, seriously, absolutely, way not an asshole. I'm just getting a smile out of him in case he reads or hears that. Anyways, for some reason, we let him hang around with us and geek out on the sound mixing stuff. After a while, Mike was kind of our regular sound guy, and we all had this kind of graduated band experience together when How's Your Day toured with Mike's sound support all the way around Lake Michigan during the final summer we all spent in the Great Lakes area together. Mike had grown up near the San Francisco Bay Area of California. Like Zoltan, he had come to MTU to get an engineering degree, and he did it. He was then planning to migrate back to his native land and get a kick-ass job and start up his own recording studio. At some point, he asked Aujourde about if and when he ever got his own recording studio together back in California, if and we would come out to make an album, and we were all like, of course! There was no question that we would. Things weren't exactly going to be happening fast anytime soon for a rock and roll band in Houghton, Michigan, and we knew it. What we didn't know was that Mike was actually really serious. After he graduated and then did that tour with us, he moved to California. The band stayed and diddle-fucked around doing whatever we were doing on through the next winter. Then he called us up. He now had the recording gear and was setting up his studio, and he wanted us to come on out and make an album. Not just one, actually. I forget the exact whens and hows, but at some point, we had ended up agreeing to cut two albums with his company, the new indie label he had named Quilted Fish Records. Mike and three other members of Patchwork Apple, singers Pete and Diane and flautist Kevin, had all moved out to share a big house in the small mountain town of Boulder Creek near Santa Cruz, just a ways south of San Fran. He now had some nice, decent recording gear and some relatively nice microphones and stuff coming together in the garage of this house, and we were all able to kind of more or less couch surf as the band landed. I ended up sleeping in that little trailer we had pulled from Michigan in the house's backyard under the redwood trees with an extension cable running out to it for $100 a month for the better part of the next year. A short time later, we were all working local jobs, which in my case was once again cooking. We had soundproofed the garage and made a separated booth in one corner for mixing, and we were learning more, but certainly not everything about recording, as fast as we could. Recording our album was educational, but often frustrating. Sometimes we'd have something that we did a poorer job of recording, but it was a good performance, and sometimes it worked the opposite way and we'd have mediocre parts that were recorded well. When we were really kicking ass, something would be both recorded well and performed well, but it would often still end up in the cloud of every other thing that was sometimes working well and sometimes not. Whether or not we wanted to admit it, we didn't have all the studio skills. We just had some startup tools and some time to work with. We had lots of ideas, and we tried many and kept many. That was fun, but without having some kind of producer to bully us into writing shorter, simpler, less eccentric-sounding stuff and getting the album done by a deadline, it turned out to be a long album full of mostly long songs that took us forever to complete. By the time it was finished, we had learned so much about recording while working on it that it seemed like we could almost just record the whole thing better if we'd started over from the beginning, but there was just too much time and energy invested already. We needed to wrap that project up. Thing was, in spite of however much better we could have done with whatever list of details on the album, we were all still proud of it. We decided to name it Stumble Proud. We pressed 1,000 copies, which was, and is still, really the basic smallest number you can get pressed and wrapped for a reasonable deal if you're still considering printing CDs, which have become less popular fast lately. After being in that house for a year, the band moved a few blocks away into a local flip house we had learned about right in downtown Boulder Creek behind the liquor store. It was being remodeled by a couple of guys we had met, and they were working on it on and off, but letting the band rent it cheap while they did. Meanwhile, Mike bought a house a few miles away in an area called Bonnie Dune, and he was permanently converting the garage there into a more serious studio with even better gear. He was doing pretty well with his job, so I guess that engineering degree did him well. My brother Brian is 6 years younger than me. After he graduated high school back in Michigan, he moved out to join us in California and shared a big room in the liquor store band house with me. I think that more or less, both he and the parents kind of wanted him to just take a little time and decide what he wanted to do after he graduated, and they all knew we'd have some fun and he'd learn a lot by moving out to hang with his bros band to help us with our gigs and stuff. I'd like to think that's what ended up happening most of the time over the next 7 or so years he lived with me in the area, in spite of him having to take care of me more and more of the time, and I'd like to think that his time as my roommate left him with more memories of funs and happies than memories of scaries and sketchies. Back when we were all in that liquor storehouse, we didn't know I had seizures yet. And though I did end up having one for sure, we didn't realize it. We didn't understand that there was any kind of real problem, so we didn't worry about any health matters, and life was totally different back then. I know we had at least some fun. So the band did manage to have some great times out there, and it played plenty of lame gigs, with a few fun and crazy ones before it finally fell apart. And it didn't fall apart easy. Over time, John, vocals and guitar, was getting more distant and disinterested. I don't think it was anybody's fault or intention, but I do think he thought the rest of us were naive about the ways of the world, and I'm sure he was right. I don't think it was that he thought any of us bandmates were jerks or anything, but I'm pretty sure he just wasn't always having so much fun anymore in general. I saw less and less of him socially, too, but then I didn't get out to the bars so much. I guess it could be said that I was less social. Either way, though, I'm pretty sure now that he didn't take very good care of himself after a point. When he and I had first become dorm mates, he didn't know how to play guitar, and I hardly knew how to sing. But after that year, we were both doing both. John then thought of himself as more of a singer that also played guitar, and I was the other way around, a guitarist who also sang. He and I both got into writing songs, sometimes together, and of course, Zoltan and Timothy also often wrote with us, but some of the songs were clearly mine and likewise some were John's. So naturally, our album Stumble Proud included some of John's tunes, and when he stopped playing with us, we were then stuck with an album with him all over it and some songs we couldn't really play without him. The rest of us weren't quite ready to give it up yet, but we now had not only a bunch of copies of this album that we couldn't play all of, but we also had t-shirts and bumper stickers and whatever other promo crap that the band with Mike and Quilted Fish Records had generated. Not only that, but we had been paying for a mixer and various other gear that the band owed for on a credit card, and we all knew we eventually had to pay that damn thing off. We played for like a year on Thursday nights at this bar in downtown Santa Cruz called the Osti, which was a weird but fun time. The crowd was there to drink and kind of ignored us most of the time, but they weren't usually too mean to us. It was a small place that had an unused kitchen in the back behind an unused service window, and we had gotten into setting up Timothy's drums in the kitchen behind a sheet of plexiglass we put over the window. This helped us keep the drums quieter in the bar room so Zoltan and me could play super small-sized, crammed into the back corner of the place with a tiny little mini PA system. Naturally, all of us bandmates are full of probably years' worth of stories from the life of that project. As I had mentioned, all of us got a little everything happens for a reason learning. So when something happened that must have meant something to any of us, what can you say? It's lived on as part of our How's Your Day family folklore. And anytime I talk to any of these brothers, I get to reminisce some of the good stuff that I may now not have thought of in quite a while. For example, when I talked to Zoltan on the phone a while back, he reminded me about the famed Miracle Guitar Case event. Like many other stories from my history, I had no memory of what he was talking about at first, and it took him getting into it a ways before my memory of it finally lit up, but so many other associated memories around it lit up too, which is how it's been a lot for me in recent years, especially since the series of surgeries I underwent at Stanford. This was after one of our gigs at the Osti, and for some reason I had gotten sick during the show. Maybe I drank too much, or maybe I had even seized at some point, but all I knew was I didn't want to drive from the Osti in Santa Cruz all the way back up into the mountains to Boulder Creek, where we all lived. Timothy knew my car well, and he'd agreed to drive it home while I lay down in the back seat. I thought I was going to puke. It was probably a little over a half-hour-long ride, and the road, mostly Highway 9, is very, very curvy. Timothy was, as usual, a methodical and focused driver, which was a good thing because I was trying not to hurl. Right when we pulled into our house and he shut off the motor, my eyes popped open with immediate horror. Oh my God, my guitar was on the roof! I immediately knew that I had left it, in its case, on the roof of the car as I had first crawled into the back seat. and there was no way it could have stayed there this far, so it had to have either slid off miles ago or been picked up by someone walking past the bar or something. Somehow, though, the unimaginable had then, in fact, happened for me. When Timothy and I got out of the car, the guitar was still on the roof, stuck with cohesion in the humidity that had condensed on the roof from the fog in the air in Santa Cruz. It's by the coast. That Monterey Bay fog had saved my axe. And that's just the kind of lucky I feel like I am right now. I've had some damn crazy odds stacked up against me, and here the fuck I still am. So anyways, my old bandmates and Mike will always be my bros. They really stuck it out for as long as possibly reasonable trying to keep How's Your Day moving, but we all knew eventually that it was time to move on. Zoltan headed back to the Chicago area where he grew up and his family lived, and Timothy headed on down the coast to Santa Barbara before long to study music. He eventually ended up getting his master's degree from the University of Santa Barbara, and he's the one out of all of us that has since made his way in music. I have so much respect for him, both as a friend and as a music wizard that I've been so fortunate to know. Lately, he's made some super tunes using his artist name ADSR. Plugging for you, buddy. Around when Zoltan left, Mike and me had a talk. See, How's Your Day had agreed to record 2 albums with Quilted Fish Records, and Mike figured I could do the second one solo and we'd just call it All Good. Mike knew that I'd learned to play a number of instruments over the years and that I'd be able to do most of the parts on the album, and we had plenty of great music friends that we could possibly recruit to help with the project as well. So, in late spring of 99, I started recording my first solo album with Quilted Fish Records. My bro Brian and I had moved down to Aptos, about a 40-minute drive away from Mike's place in Bonny Doon, and we had our new pad set up to where I was able to rock out and we could be loud and host jams and have some new adventures. Having that place helped me write and practice for the album. I did most of the instrument tracks, and Timothy was able to come up from Santa Barbara and do about half of the drum tracks and some vocals too. Our patchwork Apple pals Pete and Diane were still around and dropped in on backing vocals, which really helped finish the album up swell. Once that project was mixed and ready, I was damn proud of it. Still am. Only thing was, I had promised myself that I would not release it without having a live band together to support it, and that ended up being much easier said than done. For one thing, it was right after finishing that album that I got that first ambulance ride to the Dominican Hospital ER and we all found out I had some kind of seizure disorder. When Brian first called Mike from the ER, Mike had dropped whatever he was doing to rush over to the hospital. I know that first and foremost, Mike cared about me as his friend, who he knew was now dealing with some level of heavy medical news. But I'd also suspect that he likely very soon also had some very understandable concern about what was going to happen with the album now that he had done so much to make it with me. Indeed, some concern in that area would have been very valid. After all, it did end up taking me 7 years to eventually release that album. 7 damn blue years.
This concludes episode 2 of Shuffleptic. I'm planning to post episodes weekly, so come on back to the buffet. It's almost all you can eat. All music used in this series is original. This time, the intro music came from an intergalactic love jingle called Tidbit, and the exit music here is from an old school rumor mill tune called Word I Heard. If interested, you can hear and download plenty of my music for free here at natebnt.com and also at many free music sites. A blog, printed version of this series is also posted for those who'd prefer to read, and episodes will also be added there weekly. For a sources cited reference list, go to the end of the blog section. I'll be making an ongoing effort to make sure the list is as complete and accurate as possible. Till next week and beyond, stay safe, dandy, well, and free.